Well, good morning. If you've talked to me in the last couple weeks, I've probably told you all about how I've been doing a lot of bouldering recently. I think it's all I want to talk about right now. I guess I've gotten hooked. But one of the things, I've been in this league trying to compete, you know, trying to get better, level up my skills. I'm working on a higher level. And so Friday I went in and I worked on this one route. I know I can get it. I tried for like 45 minutes to get it. And I'm sitting there resting, staring at it, going, I feel like I can get there. I don't know. And this little gal comes in, and she does it this different way than I was doing it. She finds a hold that I didn't realize was there, and just easy peasy. And I went, oh, that's how you do it. And I realized in that moment, you know, I've been really trying to do this all on my own. I should have just asked someone what the trick was, and they would have just told me probably. It's rude in a climbing gym to give someone a suggestion unless they ask for it, you know, so no one's going to come up. But if I ask for it, you know, people are really helpful. And I realized I've been making this hard on myself the whole time. And I wonder if some of us don't do that in life, where we could be getting help. We could be working with God to do things. And instead, I got this. No, don't worry about it. I'm just going to do my own thing. I can do it. And we find ourselves trying to do something the hard way over and over, and we don't have to. I think there's a kind of a weird, reduced form of the gospel that a lot of us in American Christianity kind of let seep in sometimes, where you know, we've got a sin problem and we can't go to heaven, but Jesus took care of the sin problem by dying on the cross, and so now we can go to heaven. Good job, you got your ticket, and now you're good to do whatever until you die. And that is not the gospel that's presented in the Bible. It's like saying that Jesus paid the ticket to get in the climbing gym, and, you know, go to it, when Jesus is the best coach in the world, right? In fact, we find ourselves in life, sometimes we're not in a nice situation like a gym where everyone's polite to you. Sometimes people are knocking you off. Sometimes life gets hard. We wind up in these situations that are very difficult. Sometimes we make those situations ourselves, and sometimes they just happen. But life gets unexpectedly hard sometimes. And then we get tired and we wonder, is it worth it? Can I keep going? And that's why Hebrews is written. It's written to a group of people who had been through a lot. They'd come to faith in this exciting early days of the church, and then a couple of decades later, the economy's going rough, there's a lot of civil unrest, in just a couple of years the temple would be destroyed, there's a lot of pressure from the Romans, there's a lot of pressure from their Jewish families who are like, why have you abandoned the faith? And they're like, no, we haven't. We're actually following the faith more, and because Jesus fulfills the law. And there's a lot of tension. And so they're wondering, should I keep going? I'm tired. What is this going to do? And so we've been studying Hebrews. It talks all about Jesus and who he is and what he's doing. And the section of Hebrews ends this way with this encouragement. So do not throw away your confidence because it has great reward, for you need endurance in order to do God's will and so receive what is promised. For just a little longer and he who is coming will arrive and not delay. But my righteous one will live by faith. If he shrinks back, I take no pleasure in him. But we are not among those who shrink back and thus perish. We are among those who have faith preserve their souls. So in tough times, when the going gets rough, when we're disappointed because things haven't turned out the way they want, do you ever feel like you're following God and you've got this idea, he's called you to do this thing and it's going to be great, and then, well, it's complicated. People are complicated. Stuff doesn't work out. You don't have the money you thought you'd have to do that. You don't have the time you thought to have to do that. People don't respond the way you want them to. God doesn't do the things you thought he was going to do, and you get disappointed, and you say, what am I doing? So we need faith in those times, right? We need to hang on to that faith. But a lot of people will tell you, just have faith. Doesn't that sound like a good churchy thing to say? I've even heard people say that outside of church. You just need to have more faith. I've heard people say that in Disney movies, right? Just have more faith. Thanks. That's not helpful, right? Because the question is, faith in what? What do we have faith in, right? What does that mean to have faith? What does that look like to have faith? And so what is faith even? Hebrews says, let me tell you, Hebrews chapter 11. Now, faith is being sure of what we hope for, being convinced of what we do not see, for by it the people of old received God's commendation. So that's the definition. That's what faith is, being sure of the things you hope for, convinced of the things you don't see. Because we don't see God, but we see him moving, right? See the effects. We're all this invisible made visible, but we have to, there's that little step of faith where we can't quite see all that we like to see, right? We have faith. Okay, but how do you have faith, right? What does that look like in practice? And Hebrews chapter 11 is sometimes called the Hall of Faith because the author is going to list all of these different characters from the Hebrew Bible and say, this person had faith, and this person had faith. This is what this person did. Follow like this person did. Live like this person did, because they had faith, that God saw their faith. And so this next part of the series in Hebrews, we're going to look at a few of these characters through the eyes of what does it mean to have faith. And so I'm just going to keep reading Hebrews. We're still in chapter 11, verse 3. By faith we understand that the worlds were set in order at God's command, so that the visible has its origin in the invisible. By faith, Abel offered God a greater sacrifice than Cain, and through his faith he was commended as righteous because God commended him for his offerings. And through his faith he still speaks even though he's dead. By faith, Enoch was taken up so that he did not see death, and he was not to be found because God took him up. For before his removal, he had been commended as having pleased God. Now without faith, it is impossible to please him, for the one who approaches God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. By faith, Noah, when he was warned about the things not yet seen, with reverent regard, constructed an ark for the deliverance of his family. Through faith, he condemned the world and became an heir of righteousness that comes by faith. I love this part of Hebrews. He's set up all of this theology, and then it all pulls together in this beautiful rhetorical climax. And so if you're going to read anything this week, read Hebrews 11. It's just so exciting, the way he just builds it up. So question is, faith in what? Well, I think the clue is here in verse 3. By faith we understand that the worlds were set in order at God's command. He's talking about God's creation of the world, because God took chaos and he turned it into order, right? By his, he set it in order, is how Hebrews phrases it, right? In the Jewish conception, before creation, it wasn't that there was just nothing. There was chaos, which is a very specific kind of nothing. It's a very scary, dangerous kind of nothing, right? And God doesn't just create something out of nothing. He creates order out of chaos. And creation reflects this deeper spiritual reality. That's what Hebrews is referring to. He says, the visible comes from the things that were invisible. God's invisible. He makes his visible world. It's patterned after his thoughts, after his word, after his character. And creation's order itself makes room for the beauty that God wants to fill it with, for the abundance that God wants to fill it with. Andy Crouch spoke at the National Convention a couple months ago. There's a really cool video. If you go look up Vineyard Andy Crouch, you'll see the YouTube videos. And he does this really cool demonstration with a piano. And I think if you haven't seen it, you'd really love it. So put that on your phone or something. But Andy Crouch talks about this idea of God building order, but then also building in abundance. And so he looks at the order of creation. Now, Genesis 1 is this beautiful poem in Hebrew. It's stunning. It's got so many cool layers to it. In fact, I could talk about Genesis 1 for an hour, okay? I just, like, every time I've studied it, wow, there's more stuff here. It's really, really cool. But one of the things about Genesis 1 is it talks about these 6 days of creation, and then on the seventh he rests, and the 6 days have the symmetry to them. There's 3 days that God, it doesn't say he creates, he separates. He separates light from darkness. He separates the waters from the waters to form sky. He separates the land from the waters. It's very interesting that that's how it's phrased, right? He's creating these separations. He's creating this order, these boxes. And it's very odd when you first read Genesis 1 because you say, and God created light, but he and there's a day, and wait, the sun doesn't come around till day 4. Okay, that's kind of odd, right? So he's creating these spaces, these kinds of things, these categories, these structures, and then on days 4, 5, and 6, he fills those spaces. He fills the light and the darkness with the sun, moon, and stars. He fills the sky with birds and the water with fish. And then on the 6th day, he fills the land with animals and humans. And so this is sort of a callback to the message I spoke on with the temple, right? Because in this case, God is making this space, and then he says to the animals and to us, he says, go, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth. Here, I've made a space for you. Go and fill it with all this diversity and abundance and beauty and creativity. And then later, when he gives Moses the instructions for the temple, he says the opposite. Build the space. If you make the space, if you make the structure, I'll fill it, right? And that's the way God works. Is when we make a space for him, he fills it. And when he makes a space for us, he invites us to fill it. That's the way he works. So this is what he's doing in creation. What does that say about what God wants to do in our lives? What does it say about who he is? What does it say about what we have faith in? See, we are made in God's image. We're making the invisible visible. We're participating in what he's doing in creation. And so if we're looking at who God is, then we have to see what is the order that he wants to bring. Does he know how to structure the world? Yeah, I think so. Does he know how to structure your life? Maybe he does. Maybe he's got some suggestions for you as you climb up the wall. Maybe he could give you a tip or two because, I mean, he invented all that, right? But also, he's not into following rules for the rules' sake, right? The structure of creation is there so that he can fill it with all this creativity and diversity. If you're a creative, if you do art or music, you've experienced this weird phenomenon where constraints and structure and limitation actually help you to be more creative. Now, too many restrictions is stifling, right? You're in too small of a box, you just feel like you can't be creative. But if anything goes, it's really hard to make any sort of good art. It turns out that if you have some rules that you have to fit in, if you're trying to fit in a form, this is why haikus are fun, right? Because you've got the structure, and you have so much creativity you can put in to, what is it, 5 syllables, 7 syllables, 5 syllables, right? But it has to fit that pattern. That restriction, that order, gives you something to fill with your creativity. And so that's what God's inviting us to do. He's not inviting us to, he's not asking us to follow a bunch of rules just so he can be controlling. He's asking us to accept this framework that he's giving us so we can be fully creative, so we can be fully expressive, so we can bring beauty to the world just as he created us to. And so that's the context of creation. That's the context of faith. That's who God is. So now we talk about the next thing that's in Hebrews. He talks about this guy, Abel. By faith, Abel offered God a greater sacrifice than Cain. And I don't know about you. Maybe you're familiar with the story of Cain and Abel. Or maybe you're like, I think I've heard of those guys. What do they do? personally, this is one of the earliest stories in the Bible. It's in Genesis 4. And as a kid, you know, I had the little storybook versions of all the Bible stories, and I always thought this was the weirdest, most awkward children's storybook, because what happens in the story? Cain kills Abel, and I'm like, I don't know about this. This is kind of messed up. What are we doing? It's hard. Yeah. There's more. And so I want to take a moment to look at this story with fresh eyes, because, you know, I've never liked this story. And then I started reading Hebrews, and I said, oh, maybe there's something really important that we're supposed to see here, something that's really cool. And so I think, you know, it's always good when you're reading a Bible story to look at the context. And the good news about this is, well, there is not much context. This is chapter 4, so we don't have much to review. I could read the whole thing if you wanted. Anyone? No? Okay. I'll sum up. So we just talked about creation. God creates the world. It's great. It's beautiful. It's awesome. Creation shows God's goodness. He creates Adam and Eve, puts them in this beautiful garden. He gives them all the trees in the garden to eat except for one. And so that becomes the sticking point, of course, because Adam and Eve didn't trust that God wasn't holding out on. They said, well, what about that one? Yeah, you can have any of the other trees, any of them. There's so many great trees out there. What about that one, right? God, are you holding out on me? And I wonder how many of us have had that conversation, maybe not verbally, maybe not consciously with God, but God, are you holding out on me? Like, I feel like you're not quite giving me what I really wanted, right? I feel like there's something a little bit more, and sometimes I feel that way. I sometimes feel like, God, why are you holding me back, right? Well, everything I have is what he's given me. I wouldn't get this far without him, but sometimes I ask that. And so Adam and Eve get kicked out of the garden, and because they wouldn't trust God. They wouldn't trust God that all the goodness and abundance that he'd provided them was enough. So God says, okay, you want to know what's enough? Well, then why don't you try it on your own and see how that goes. Well, Adam and Eve have these two sons. The oldest is named Cain, and the youngest is named Abel. And so we pick up in Genesis 4, and the man was intimate with his wife Eve. She became pregnant, gave birth to Cain, and she said, I have created a man just as the Lord did. Then she gave birth to his brother Abel. Abel took care of the flocks while Cain cultivated the ground. It's kind of interesting. You know, Eve sounds kind of pretentious here, but actually I think this is in line with God's goals for creation. He gives us that creative power. We get to share that with him. And I think if you look in the Hebrew, she gives a little bit more credit to God. With God's help, I have obtained a man, is what the Hebrew literally says. So Abel's becomes a shepherd. First shepherd. Cain becomes the first farmer. Farmer Cain. At the designated time, Cain brought forth some of the fruit of the ground as an offering to the Lord. But Abel brought some of the firstborn of his flock, even the fattest of them. The Lord was pleased with Abel and his offering. But with Cain and his offering, he was not pleased. So Cain became very angry, and his expression was downcast. Now, the question I think that most people jump to at this point is, why was Abel's sacrifice better? Like, what was it that made it better? And John, do you want to say it, or should I? I mean, Cain really tried, right? But in the end, he just wasn't able. Okay. That's just for John. That's terrible. That's the problem. Well, so what's interesting is the Bible doesn't really spell this out. I wonder how much it matters. I don't know if this is really the point, but I think there's a clue. First, in Hebrews. Hebrews says Abel had faith. He made a sacrifice in faith. Cain didn't. Okay. So how do you see that? I think there's an interesting clue in the text where Cain brought some of his stuff. He gave God some stuff. And Abel brought his firstborn of his flock and his fattest. He brought his best. Firstborn is scary because if you're a farmer, you get the first fruits. Man, I'm starving. What if something happens? Maybe I need to go ahead and save these for seeds for next year. It takes a lot to trust that there's going to be more after that. You know, maybe you're going through and, well, you know, there's those perfect little carrots you get. It's just beautiful, and you're like, wow. And then there's like the weird ones that are kind of like, I guess it's technically edible, but I don't know. It just doesn't. And so I wonder if Cain was like, I'm just going to keep that one. That's nice. I want to eat that one. And, oh, I've got some leftover vegetables. Let's bring it to God. I don't know. It doesn't spell it out. But I wonder if there's that aspect of faith where Abel said, there's going to be more. God's going to continue to bless me. I trust him to do that, so I'm going to bring him my first fruits. I'm going to bring him my best. And so the Lord was pleased with Abel, but with Cain, he was not pleased, so Cain became very angry. Oh, wait. Moshe, did you get that wrong? Did you mean that God got angry? Isn't that how we kind of hear it? Like, God accepted, he was pleased with Abel, but he was angry with Cain, right? But it doesn't say that. Who was angry in this passage? Well, only Cain was angry. The Lord wasn't pleased with the sacrifice. He wasn't angry about it, right? We sometimes project that on God. But Cain gets angry. We tend to have this idea that God's kind of harsh, right? He's kind of, you know, I mean, he's the law, you know. You don't mess with that. That's scary. He's, you know, he's pretty clear about what he wants. So, like, you don't want to mess up with God, right? Now, I wonder if we got that idea from the authority figures in our own lives. If we have fathers or our teachers or someone else in our lives that maybe we're harsh. Maybe we get this kind of bad theology that seeps in from the way people talk about God. And they talk about God as someone who's kind of angry and looking for any excuse to send people to hell, right? So what does Hebrews 11:6 suggest about God wasn't pleased? We want to know why God wasn't pleased. He wasn't angry, but he wasn't pleased either. Well, what does Hebrews 11:6 say? Now, without faith, it's impossible to please him. So apparently Cain didn't have faith. For the one who approaches God must believe that he exists and rewards those who seek him. I wonder if Cain believed he existed, but he didn't believe that maybe God was going to reward him for seeking him. He didn't trust in God's goodness to him. Again, faith in what? Faith that God is going to continue to be good to you. Faith that God actually loves you. So God wasn't pleased, but if we continue the story, that wasn't like the end of the story with Cain. It wasn't like, well, that's it. You had your shot. No. It's like, yeah, that wasn't really what I wanted, but, you know, maybe try again. Maybe try again tomorrow, right? So what happens next? And the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? And why is your expression downcast? Is it not true that if you do what's right, you'll be fine? But if you do not do what's right, sin is crouching at the door. It desires to dominate you, but you must subdue it. Yeah, you know, God keeps on having this conversation with him. It's like, watch out. Watch out. This isn't the end. If you do what's right, it's going to work out. So just do what's right, right? Okay. And then this is where it takes an ugly turn. Cain said to his brother Abel, let's go out to the field. While they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, where is your brother Abel? Now, that's stunning to me. This is a horrible thing because why is murder so, so very bad in God's eyes? It's because we have the image of God. When you kill someone, you're destroying the image of God. You're attacking the image of God. That's kind of bad. And yet, God doesn't smite him. Is it smiting time already? Come on, God. Why are you letting him get away with this? And yet he says, where's your brother Abel? He leads with curiosity, just like he did with Adam and Eve in the garden, just like he did when he spoke to Cain earlier. He leads with curiosity. And I want to point out that this whole time, Cain's on speaking terms with God, apparently. They're just having these conversations. So sometimes we go, well, was it really fair to Cain? Like, how is he supposed to know that God didn't like his vegetables, you know? I mean, I don't know about you, but if I get the sense that Marissa's not super happy with something I got her, I'd ask. I said, hey, this doesn't seem to be your favorite flavor. What is your favorite flavor for next time, right? It only took me 3 times trying to find out that salted caramel was her favorite ice cream at Josh and John's. You can all put that in your notes for later. She's like, this isn't my favorite flavor. Oh, I should really make a note, right? I asked, right? So it seems like we could lead with curiosity. And so God says, watch out. Sin's crouching at the door. And Cain reacts the way we typically do. Cain says, I don't know. Am I my brother's guardian? Sometimes it's translated, am I my brother's keeper? But the Lord said, what have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground. So you're banished from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. So he's banished. Okay, he's driven out from this community. Because once you've enacted this act of violence, how are you supposed to continue to be part of a community, right? And so it's stunning. He still doesn't smite him. Even as punishment, though, God doesn't want him killed. Cain says, well, this is too harsh. You're being too harsh, God. Well, I don't know, man. He should have, you know, eye for an eye, you know, you should have been killed in his place. I don't know. It seems like you're getting off easy just being banished. But Cain's like, it's too hard. And so God gives him this extra thing. It's sometimes referred to as the mark of Cain, where if anyone attacks Cain, Cain will be avenged 7 times as much. God basically says there's a curse on anyone who attacks him. I've meted out the justice that needed to be meted out here, and that's not anyone else's job. And it's so fascinating to me that even in this horrible, horrible story, God still comes to him with compassion. He doesn't stop speaking to him. He doesn't cut him off. Even in his punishment, God still cares for him. But Cain's reaction is the way we typically react. He deflects. He denies. I don't know. Am I the brother's keeper? Have you seen him? I haven't seen him, right? He disclaims any responsibility. I don't know. It's so fascinating to me that people who do something very damaging, whether it's, you know, they cheat or they harm someone or whatever, you confront them on it. Well, it's not my fault. I mean, this thing happened, and then I just, you know, it's not my fault. It's like, I don't know, man, you're the one who did it, you know. You may have had circumstances that brought you to that point, but you pulled the trigger, you know. And so that's exactly what Cain does in the very first murder, and it's still what we're doing today. When you catch yourself denying and deflecting and disclaiming responsibility, it's a sign that sin's crouching at the door. It's a sign that you're about to be devoured. It's a sign that instead of trying to get out of God's view, maybe you should go to him with confidence, with boldness, knowing that he loves you and cares for you. Because what did Cain believe about God? Cain believed that God was holding out on him, just like Adam and Eve did in the garden. That God was going to be angry with him, that God was looking for ways to punish him. But what was God actually like? Curious, compassionate, interested, caring. And so this is how our perspective of God has such a huge effect on our faith. Because what do we have faith in? I don't think a faith in an angry God is really going to get us anywhere, right? But a faith in a God who cares about us and loves us and wants the best for us and wants abundance for us, I think that's a powerful thing. And so, how do we have faith? How do we have faith like Abel? Let's look at verse 6 one more time in Hebrews 11. Now, without faith, it's impossible to please him, for the one who approaches God must believe that he exists and he rewards those who seek him. He exists and he rewards those who seek him. I mean, there's that word again, reward. We talked about this last week, about how we have an inheritance or a reward. And we get some of this inheritance now, because as part as an heir, you're part of the family business. You have access to some of it now. And some of it's to come. We won't see the fullness of this inheritance until the day of the Lord. So, just a quick review from last week. What's the inheritance? Anyone remember? It's okay. You can all review the recording later. The inheritance is communion with God. We get to be in God's presence. We get to experience him. We get to know his love personally and speak to him on a daily basis. We get blessing from him. We get his favor. His face shines upon us. We get freedom from guilt and shame, the sin that entangles. We get to be part of the family business. We get to do the things that God is doing in the world and bring his kingdom, let his kingdom come among us. Participate in healing and blessing and loving and feeding the poor. These are all things that God's always doing, and we get to be part of that. The inheritance comes with a promise. A promise that all things will be made new. And we get to start that process now. We get a reward. We get heavenly stuff. The Bible doesn't really go into detail about what stuff this is, but Jesus says, lay up your treasures in heaven. So, I mean, I guess there's stuff that we get that doesn't perish with the earth. And our inheritance is also rest. We get to rest in him. We get to take that Sabbath as a reminder that Jesus didn't make us so that we could work hard, but he made us so that we could rest in him. And so notice that in this chapter of faith, Hebrews doesn't talk about salvation at all. We've talked about that. We've talked about how Jesus entered the temple as a high priest, but also as a sacrifice, that he made a way for us in. But now we're talking about living by faith. We've passed through the veil, but now what? Now, sometimes people get so stuck on theological rules that they've kind of extracted about who is and who isn't saved and all sins and our righteousness is like filthy rags and all that good stuff, right? And they forget about Hebrews 11, because Abel didn't have the book of Romans. And yet, in Hebrews 11, Abel was commended as righteous because of his faith. God said, you're a righteous person. And that kind of messes with our very nice systematic theology sometimes, because we like to say, well, there's a formula to righteousness. Well, no, God says you had faith. You believed in my goodness, my plan for you, my love for you. And so I'm going to count that as righteous, because that's how you lived your life. It's very interesting. So I'd like to suggest we want to know, what is faith? What do we have faith in? Faith is spiritual knowledge that God is good and trustworthy. He is who he says he is. And the thing is, his goodness can be hard to see in the world sometimes, because the world's kind of messed up, broken. There's things that aren't right. There's a lot of mess. And so it's hard to see his goodness reflected in the world. That's why it's important to go back to the Genesis account and understand what it was that God was trying to do, what his project was. It's good to go to him and ask him with curiosity, what are you trying to do in this situation? Why aren't you smiting this person who seems to deserve it? And why are you blessing this person who seems to not? And why aren't you giving me the thing that I think that I need? What do I actually need, right? I think we also need to examine our ideas about God. Where do we get those? Are we making up a cruel, careless God in our heads? Sometimes we imagine God to be kind of capricious, right? He's kind of being hard on me. Where are we getting that idea? Are we projecting that on him from someone else we've seen? Or are we picturing Jesus? Are we picturing the Jesus that's revealed through the Gospels? We're picturing the Jesus that's revealed through our intimate times of prayer. That's why Hebrews takes 10 chapters up to this point to tell us all the ways that Jesus is better, all the things that Jesus has done, who he really is, so we can understand who it is that we're believing in, what we're putting our faith in. Are we taking risks? Are we actually, the thing about faith, Phil, the thing about trusting that God is actually good and wants our best, is that we have to actually put weight on that. I'm going to talk about climbing some more, because that's all I'm thinking about, apparently. But it's so interesting. There's some holds that are like big handles that are just really easy to hold on to, and there's some that they're just kind of flat. There's nothing to really grip. You just put your hand on it, and you can slip off really easily. And the thing about those is, if you don't put weight on them, they won't do anything. The more weight you put on them, the more friction you have, and that friction is what holds you. And so if you're not willing to trust that hold, and that's what people say in the gym all the time, trust it, trust that foot, trust that hold. They say that because you need to put weight on it. And if you don't put weight on it, it's not gonna do anything. And so that's how it is with God. Sometimes we say, well, I have faith that God's good, but I'm just going to, you know, just going to protect my bank account anyway. I'm just going to, you know, try to stay under the radar at work so that, you know, hopefully I make it to the next round of layoffs. I'm just going to, you know, try to not stir up anything over here because I'm just going to keep my head down. Even though God's saying, try something new. Step out. Learn something. Experiment. Take a risk. Maybe invite that person to John Beth's barbecue. You know, maybe that's not that big of a risk. Maybe pray and see if God has a word for them. Maybe share that with them. Maybe text someone in encouragement. It's really low risk things that are just that first step, right? But if we're not taking those risks, do we actually have faith? Do we actually trust in God? I've spoken for long enough, so we're going to wrap it up, and the band's going to come back, and we'll worship for a few more minutes. But the thing about this is I can't reveal the truth of God's goodness to you. I can talk about it a bunch. I can read the scripture. Only God's Spirit can do that. Only God's Spirit can confirm that truth to you. If you're willing to lean in, if you're willing to be curious, if you're willing to listen, I think God will reveal himself to you. And so that's what I want to close with. Are you willing to trust that God's way is better? At the beginning, we talked about how he created order and then filled it with abundance. And sometimes we are resistant to the order that God has. Again, he's not about, following the rules for rules' sake. He's not trying to get you on technicalities. He's not that guy. He's not that bureaucrat. But he does have an order. He does have commandments. He does have things that he wants us to do. And in fact, he invites us to let him write his law on our hearts. Hebrews quotes that verse over and over because this is something that Abel didn't have even. This is something that Cain didn't have. It's this invitation for God to write his law on our hearts. And I think his warning to Cain is for us too. That sin is crouching at the door. It wants to devour you. If you don't trust God, if you try to manage your own problems, your own mistakes, your own issues, the sin will crouch at the door and it becomes bigger and bigger. If you accept that God's order is good and for your good and let him write it on your heart, then sin that wants to devour won't harm you. His order also involves rest. He created the world in 6 days, and on the seventh he rests. He built that seventh day into the order of creation. Because creation isn't about our production. It isn't about how hard we try. Are we willing to trust that his way is better in rest? Actually stopping our activity. Actually ceasing. And are we willing to believe God actually has abundance for us? Not always exactly in the forms and timing that we sometimes expect, but that he actually does want good things for him. And if we trust him, if we follow him, then he will bring this to us at the right time. It requires us to hold those things with an open hand. When I started dating Marissa, things got serious, and I've been single for a long time, and this is going really good, and I'm about to get engaged, I'm so excited, and I got really scared. I'm like, what if something happens? What if everything goes horribly wrong? You know, what if a meteor strikes or a bus hits, and I'm just like, I can't take the loss. And I started holding on to her really tightly in my heart, right? And God said, I need you to continue holding her with open hands. He said, do you trust me that I gave you her because she's good for you? And do you believe that if something happened, that would mean that I have something better, right? I started holding on to my house really tightly after the fire. I nearly lost my house, you know. I was out of it for 7 months. And God said, are you willing to open your hand again? Hold your house with open hands. That if your house burned down, that I would give you something better. Because he did in the fire. I got a whole new kitchen out of it, right? Are you willing to believe that I got you something better? I'm worried about my job. And I'm like, I don't know. We're having, you know, problems finding good customers. And I don't know. But I might lose my job. Do you believe that if you lost your job, that I have something better for you? The things I've put in your hand, I put in your hand because they're good. And if I take them out of your hands, it's because I want to make room for something better. Is that something that you're willing to trust? Are you willing to trust that he's not holding back on you? He has something better, but you don't deserve it. The lie we tell ourselves, right? Maybe he's playing games with you, right? It's another lie we tell ourselves, that God could bless you, but he wants to see how many times you're going to cuss this week, you know. So it's over your average of 7.6 times a day, so no blessing for you today, right? Is he playing games with us? No, I don't think he is. Now, sometimes he has time. There's all these relational aspects to it. Sometimes he's holding on to something because he's waiting for you to actually stop, listen, look at him, open your hands so you can receive it, right? Sometimes he wants to give us things and we're not willing to receive them. There's all kinds of relational dynamics at play. But if we don't trust that he has good things for us, that he's not holding back on us, that he's not playing games with us, then we're going to start having these weird behaviors like Cain did. That sin crouching at the door is going to want to devour us. So that's the invitation this morning, is take a moment with God this morning and say, show me the places where I've doubted you. Show me the places where I haven't trusted you with my whole heart. Show me the ways in which I've resisted your framework, your order, the things that you've asked me to do, the lines that you've drawn. Show me the places where I've said my way is better and I want to do it my way and I don't want your help. I want you to ask him to soften your heart, to show you those places, and to let him have his way.